It's good to see everybody here this morning. We have our campers back, which is a good thing. And it's just good to see everybody here. And it's about time to get cranked up. I know we've enjoyed visiting with each other, but we do need to get our class started. Yes, we are continuing our studies on the miracles of Jesus. And before we get to our miracles in John chapter 2, go ahead and turn to John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. And we're going to be studying the miracle of Jesus changing the water into wine at the wedding in Cana. But before we do that, I think it's good for us to always kind of bear in mind that we have certain limitations. When we begin to talk about miracles, I remember many years ago, one of my instructors at Southwest made the observation, and he said it more than once, I think probably to help it sink in, is that we cannot explain the mechanics, and that's the terminology he used, of a miracle. We have no way to understand. In fact, I think Brother Brian last week made the great observation, and that is that, like with Jesus walking on the water, what law of nature was suspended in order to do that? Was it the change of the molecular construction of the water under his feet? Was it the suspension, temporary suspension of gravity where he was? We don't understand how that works. That goes way beyond the finite mind comprehension ability. What we do know is that we have adequate evidence that these miracles took place. And we know the purpose of the miracles. They were never done just simply to appease somebody. They were never done frivolously. Then somebody, you know, Jesus didn't wake up one morning and say, you know, I believe I'll do a miracle today. No apparent reason for it, but I believe I'll do that. There were never frivolous reasons for doing miracles. They always served a purpose. And what I want to do on this one is, first of all, read the first 11 verses of John chapter 2. Therein contains the miracle and the setting and the circumstances around it. And one of the things that we notice in the very beginning is that this was the beginning of the miracles of Jesus. This was the starting point. This was the genesis of all the miracles that Jesus would do and amazing things that he would accomplish. And then I want to spend just a little bit of time and actually focus on the miracle itself. Because sometimes I think we get wrapped up in other things and we forget just exactly what was done. We'll try to make some comparisons, if you will. Now, first of all, let's read this. And on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now, both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set there six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. And when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Okay, so we start out with the miracle itself. We read the story, and one of the things that we oftentimes get so caught up in is some of the minutiae, if you will, the tiny little stuff sometimes that are good for other studies, but we're not going to take the time with them today. Right now, our focal point is the miracle itself and what was accomplished. And of course, we're going to talk about the wine that's under consideration. We kind of almost obligatory that we do that. But let's first look at the miracle itself. What was accomplished here? Think about this for a moment. We had a material. It was called water. Something as simple as water. That element of water was then what? Changed to wine. Under normal circumstances, what we think in terms of, in our mind's eye, what we would think in terms of wine, even, by the way, even if you don't think in terms of wine being the fresh fruit of the vine, the juice that is squeezed out or expressed out of the grape itself as being wine, we understand something about that process, don't we? The vines have to be planted. They have to be maintained. They have to be watered. They take an enormous amount of time for the moisture that hits the earth to take up the minerals and all the nutrients necessary to make that vine grow, and then go out into the branches to create then these little clusters of grapes. We're talking about an enormous amount of time. What did Jesus do? He took the water, as we might think of it, that normally falls out of the sky, that would have watered the plants, and instantaneously, he changes one element, water, into something that has multiple facets to it. You see, a lot of times people think in terms of this miracle as being something, well, what was miraculous is, and I don't know enough about wine to tell you what I'm about to say. What is it, Sauvignon? I don't know what this stuff is. Okay, I don't know the technical terms, but a high end, very expensive type of wine that you'd go to a store and you know, I want your finest that you have. And we'll talk about that aspect of it in a moment. You know, but stop and think about just the idea of changing something instantaneously that went into a pot as nothing more than H2O, plain old water. And Jesus simply had them fill it up and then told them to dip from it and take it to the master of the feast. And in that process, that instantaneous process, it became, that plain simple water became wine. Let's make a real quick parallel to this. Can you imagine for just a moment the miraculous nature, and we're going to use some parallels that we can relate to, is you go out and you're driving through town and you see a vacant lot, and on that vacant lot, there's a pile of lumber. And you look away, and a moment later, you look back, and you have an entire home constructed. Okay? Not just lumber, folks. The concrete for the foundation, the wiring that's needed for the electrical work, the plumbing, the piping, the everything that you need. Roofing materials, you name it, and that house is completed. That would be a similar concept, wouldn't it? You took one element, the lumber, and you look away and you look back, and guess what's happened? You have an entire home sitting there. Now, who among us would not just about drop their jaw when they saw something like that happen. When all of a sudden you had one element that turned into a complete home, finished out. And yet that's what Jesus does here. He takes water and turns it into something that has all the different, and I don't know all the stuff that's in it, like I think it's got like, wine has things like tannic acid and of course the sugars in it and all this stuff that have gone up through the vines into the grape to create that grape, to create the juice within the grape. So you don't have to stretch your mind at all to think about this miracle in thinking of just simply terms of grape juice. That would be an amazing thing. And yet we have a tendency in our society. In fact, I've had a across the desk. I don't know, it wasn't a public debate, but it's kind of across the desk of a member one time. And we were discussing this very thing right here. And he was trying to prove, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. He was trying to prove by John chapter 2 that Jesus created an intoxicating beverage. You can't do that. It's not within the text. By in and of itself, this one text is not enough. So you look at these things, and you know, we could use other examples, you know, other parallels. Can you imagine seeing a motor of a car sitting on a garage floor? You turn around, you turn back around, and guess what? It's a completely built car. One item turns into the entire finished product. Of course you would be amazed by that. And yet that's what Jesus did. And again, I think it's important for us to understand. Jesus' miracles were never partial. In other words, when I say partial, they weren't partially accomplished. Or they weren't... A term that y'all probably don't, a lot of us don't really understand. It's an old term. But it wasn't kind of jerry-rigged or something like that. And I'll give you an example of that here in just a moment. But it was complete, and it corrected an abnormality a blind man could see. I had a friend years and years ago, and he was a wonderful young man. And Richard and I had a lot of religious discussions. He was part of a religious group that really believed in modern day miracles and a lot of hand waving and all this kind of stuff. And he came into work one day and he told me that he had seen a man restore sight to a blind man. I went, really? Well, tell me what happened on this thing. And he began to explain that this guy had an artificial eye. And he was blind, obviously, in that eye. He couldn't see with that eye. But the man made him to be able to see through an artificial eye. And I went, wait a minute. In all the miracles of the Bible, do you recall somebody having like a withered arm and Jesus gave him a prosthetic limb? Do we think the man who was blind that Jesus caused to be able to see with a matter of making a paste of mud to put on his eyes had been given artificial eyes to see with? They were all these miracles were always superseding that which was natural. Didn't violate God's laws, but it superseded God's laws. And so we look at these things, and that's exactly what Jesus did. He superseded, he took something that would have normally taken more elements and taken more time and did it instantaneously. The normal process for getting that fluid, the rain water, and everything that it would take to go up into the vines and into the grape would have taken months. But Jesus did it instantaneously, and it wasn't a fake thing. It was wine. Now, any comments or thoughts before we move on? Y'all are being too quiet, and I'm not seeing any hands go up. Yes.
So line two was, she said, the best one there was. It wasn't just the open line. He said, you say the best for last. So isn't it just superseded against the major? Just in all aspects, it was the best.
It was superior, wasn't it? That's an excellent point. And she was reading my mind because we're about to get to that. So let's go ahead and jump to that real quickly. You stop and think about what the master said here. Master Feast tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants knew that it was drawn from the water. And it says the master of the feast called the bridegroom and he said, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior wine. You've kept the good wine till now. It was the best that would have normally been offered. It was so superior to what this man had offered in the beginning of the feast. Which, let me make a real quick observation. If we run out of time here, let's make a quick observation. If not, we'll re-emphasize it in a moment. When you look at the process of what we call today wine, we always think in terms of wine as what? Intoxicating. It's got some level of alcohol in it. And we think of it in terms of alcohol. The people of that day, the ancients of that day, understood something. That is when it began to change from the freshly pressed juice to something that had alcoholic content, the ancients of that day, the people of Rome, even as corrupt as they were, the people of the Grecian Empire and that, recognized that was the beginning stage of decline. Because you know what comes after? If you produce a wine and then you leave it, I think over time, if it just a little bit of air gets to it, you know what it degrades to? Vinegar. Or at least something that is very similar to vinegar. You see, once it starts that process of going from something way up here in the quality of freshly expressed juice from the grapes, pressed out, and something that you could drink without any intoxication, the next step goes into degrading. It goes downhill. It's not improving. It's getting worse. And left to itself, it'll eventually ruin. So, you know, these things are important, and that's an excellent point, Catherine, that what he made was the superior stuff. The New King James renders that good. What does he say? Every man brings forth good wine. Okay. Kept the good wine until now. But thou hast kept the good wine until now. The word good is used. That the superior wine is what was being kept. And I think that's really important for us to understand too when we begin to look at the whole picture. Now, yes?
Jesus had the power to work miracles.
I'm sorry?
Jesus had the power to work miracles.
Well, yes. And when he did, again, he didn't do it halfway, did he? He didn't do kind of a slipshod effort, didn't produce a slipshod effort at doing a miracle. It was always exactly what was needed and accomplished exactly what it was meant to accomplish. So that's a good point. As we talked about before and we've talked about in other classes, a miracle is something that supersedes natural law. As we understand natural law, it does not violate God's created laws. You know, and I wanted to put that emphasis in there. As we understand natural law. And why I want to put that in there is we don't always understand even everything around us. That's why we're still learning. We're still growing. We're still trying to. That's why we still have scientists that are trying to find things out because we don't know everything. What we, at one point in time in our history, what we thought was true science, we found out is not true science. We were wrong. Man was wrong. But God, when a miracle was performed, it didn't super, it superseded what we think in terms of as natural law. It went beyond, but it didn't violate God's law. God wouldn't be God if he violated his own laws. He simply takes what's there within that amazing ability of his and, if you will, corrects something. So I think that's something we need to understand. God doesn't violate his own laws. The blind person is never given an artificial eye to see with. Somebody who was lame, withered arm, Jesus or any of the apostles that had the ability to perform miracles didn't give somebody a prosthetic limb. They made what was there whole again. They made those eyes that could not see, see again. Or see, period. A lame person was not given an artificial leg to walk on. We've got some interesting and unbelievable stuff nowadays in prosthetics. All you have to do is watch and pay attention to what's going on in that field. And we've got prosthetics now that are like functions like a real hand. And it's crazy. I'm thinking, man, that's amazing what they can do. But it's still an artificial limb. We can't go in and regrow somebody's withered arm or arm that has been lost in an IED over in Afghanistan or something like that. We don't have that ability. Jesus could put the arm back. Now that's astounding to me. That's an amazing thing to me. Now, any other comments or thoughts before we continue on? Okay, very quickly. Yeah. Oh, yes, ma'am.
I don't think Mary. Do you think Mary understood what she was asking? I mean, it was kind of an innocent.
Well,
thing. Or she knew he could do it, but she didn't know for what reason he might do it.
Okay. Yeah, you know, that's one of those things that I was kind of saying, you know, kind of like reserve that for a different class. Why would he say something like, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour is not yet come," and then turn around and do something? You know, I think there's more to that than sometimes that we read into it. But we'll pass on that and try to get that sometime and maybe do something on that. I think that'd be that's a good study by itself. So, but here's what we want to deal with real quickly here. The words that we have to use, and I know we've talked about these before, other people have, I know you've probably heard these before, but they're good to go back over. Sometimes we forget, you know, exactly what's involved, and maybe we have an opportunity to sit down and study with somebody like I have before, and trying to say that, well, see, it proves right here, the Bible says that he made wine out of the water. And there's terminology here. Look at what the master said. Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then he puts out the inferior. But you've kept the good wine until now. Well, fitting in with what Catherine said, back in those days, the best wine was considered the very freshest wine. That is, that which came right out of the grape. Oftentimes, and it's been argued that they didn't have the ability to preserve that wine, that immediately after they took the grapes to the grape vat, to the press, and began to mash them out, that from that point on, it began to degrade immediately. And there's no way they could have kept that. Yes, they did have means of storage where it would not immediately go. In fact, we have recorded history as far back as the Egyptians, who actually found a way to concentrate their grape juice, seal it, so that air didn't get to it, and then as they needed it, they would take it out, as we might think of it, a jar, take it out of that jar, mix it, remix it with water, and it was a good product to drink that it had zero alcoholic content. Yes?
There's an advertisement out right now for a park fair grader that you can take stuff out.
Yes.
And then give seals back to the parks.
I've seen that one, yes.
So that's basically what you're saying.
In a sense, yes. Because what that does is if you didn't hear what Sister Joyce said, there's a TV ad out right now, and I don't remember the name of this product, but you can stick it down into the cork of the bottle of wine. It goes through. It's kind of like it's a nasty looking a needle like you might get if you were donating blood. You know, it's about that big around, or those that you donate blood with are that big around. But it goes down in that bottle, and you're able to pour your wine out of there, pull it, and that cork reseals itself. Well, in a sense, that's kind of what her point is, kind of what they were able to do. They were able to seal that paste of grape juice, or grape, it became a concentrate, a really strong concentrate, for future use. They did know how to preserve it. Everything didn't have to go automatically start turning into wine, and as we would use the word wine today. That's an excellent point. Very quickly, how much time do I have? About 15 or so, a little bit better. Let's talk about the words that we use, because the King James, and in fact most of them, use the term wine when very specific words in the Hebrew. The most used, I think, is the word yayin. And it is the most parallel word to the Greek word oinos. They're the closest in comparison. And when you look at these words, and I'm not 100% sure about yayin, but I am 100% sure about oinos, that the word oinos in our English Bibles as translated wine or something of that nature actually can be the grape, or the juice still inside the grape on the vine. See, we have to understand, we have to allow context to determine what we're doing, what we're talking about. And when you start thinking about that, let's just wrestle with this for just a moment. This is what's sometimes referred to as the Cana argument. This miracle in and of itself does not prove, nor does it disprove, that Jesus made an intoxicating beverage. If you take just this verse, just this one thing right here, and our understanding, you cannot come away from that. And when you see the word wine, you can't come to a conclusion one way or the other. You have to know some history, and you have to understand the usage of the words like we're doing right now. You know, a lot of people would look at and have done this. They've looked at what the master of this feast says. Well, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine when the guests have well drunk, and which, by the way, that would mean that they were plastered and they were so drunk they couldn't stand up, according to some people. Then you give them that other. You have kept the good wine until now. Well, see, they automatically assume that the good wine that he's talking about here is something that you would go to your local liquor store and buy the finest wine that they had in the shop. But that's an assumption that you can't make. The text itself, you have to bring everything else into the picture. So the argument is, well, see, it says so right here in your Bible. Jesus made wine out of water, and they drank it. And there were people there who were well drunk. In other words, they were just so drunk they couldn't stand up anymore. Well, that's just not true. You have nothing to base. We have nothing to base that on. Likewise, it does not prove or disprove that the wine was not intoxicating. See, we have to go beyond this. We have to look at the entire Bible. And we have to take in context, we have to understand when a certain word is used. The word, sometimes the concept of wine does not necessarily mean an intoxicating beverage, and it's bad. Sometimes it doesn't have that connotation. Many times it does. So look at the whole context. I was going to bring a book and I didn't do that. I wish I'd have brought that book with me. I had two books that I was going to bring with me, and I was afraid I wasn't going to have enough time, and I was going to have enough time. One of them, if you don't have this, there is a book out by Brother Jeffcoat. I think it's W.D. Jeffcoat. And it's The Christian in Social Drinking. It is an excellent, excellent, excellent book to read. Not long ago, on our back tables out here, we had a book by a non-Christian, and his name was Patton. And it was Bible Wines, I believe it is. And it what makes his interesting is he was a non-Christian, and he was not necessarily looking to prove that using alcoholic beverages were bad, just the excess use of alcoholic beverages was bad. Do you know what his conclusion was? Not surprisingly, after he really studied the subject well, he came to the conclusion that a Christian has no business using alcoholic beverages at all. And yes, they are sinful for the Christian to use. That's what made that little book interesting. Not that it was written by this guy who was trying to prove, but he was trying to prove just the opposite. Well, you can drink some and you're okay. That's not what he came away with. That wasn't his ultimate conclusion. I thought that was really interesting. But if you ever have a chance, I remember highlighting some things in about 11 page or 9 page section there. But Brother Jeffcoat makes some excellent points on that. If you ever get a chance to get one of those books, they're not expensive. They're hardback, so they'll last forever. You might want to get one. But he does make the point that freshly expressed grape juice, immediately made from water, is no less miraculous than some of the other things that we see. Maybe more miraculous, since the juice had not started that decaying process of fermentation. That to me is what made it so incredible. But the Cana argument is not sufficient. You can't go in and look at this one thing and say, see, I can prove this. And somebody else says, no, I can take that passage only and prove this. Because we can't do that. We have too many other passages in the scriptures, without taking a lot of time to go to them right now, we have too many other passages in the scriptures that teach us of the debilitating nature of alcohol, the corrupting nature of alcohol, to try to go to one particular thing here. Again, notice what happens in our text. Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then he puts out the inferior. He says, you've done just the opposite. You put the inferior out first. And now you bring the very best that we have, that you can have, before it starts that degrading process, that decaying. It really is a decaying process. Yes.
And the fact that he was able to distinguish between the two tells us that he wasn't intoxicated.
That was exact point. Thank you. Man, I'm gonna close y'all off back there. You're taking all my good points away. First Catherine, and then you. But that is exactly right. If you did not hear what Stephen said, the mere fact that he could distinguish when he got and tasted that he could distinguish between that which was good and that which was bad, proves that what they had before was not an intoxicating beverage. Because he wouldn't have been able to drink, he wouldn't have been able to taste the difference either by that point, if he was, quote, well drunk.
It wasn't even what was good and what was bad, it was what was good and what was bad.
Okay,
and
yeah.
A lot easier, harder to do to distinguish between a good something and a better something than a good something and a bad thing.
That's an excellent point there. I hadn't thought about that. That's so true. It's easier if you have on something on one end of the spectrum and the other end of the spectrum, you say, wow, that's good and that was bad. But when they're pretty close together, they're relatively close together, it's harder to make that distinguishing mark in there. Brother Hedick.
What makes this kind of really come to mind is the fact that he made 120 to 150 gallons of wine.
Okay. Yeah. He didn't just make a little dipper full or something. When he was able to take the King James, I think, uses the term a firkin, stone pots purifying with firkins apiece, 2 to 3, and I think I've got a notation that that's about 20 to 30 gallons apiece. So if you just took a halfway point in there, and you had those 6 water pots, and they just, instead of 6, 60 to 90, say you hit split one about 75 times 6. My math is not that good, but I bet you it's a bunch. How's that? Best I can do right off the top of my head. That's a bunch of wine being made. He didn't just take a tiny bit that maybe could have fooled somebody. Well, where'd that come from? Man, he had these 6 water pots, and it says what? They were filled to the brim. So there's every aspect of this was just incredible. Now let's quickly get back before we run out of time. We only got about 5 minutes or so. The oinos is the most used word in the New Testament that is translated as wine. Like the Hebrew word yayin, the definition is assigned to oinos comes literally from the context in which it stands. Just like in the Old Testament, when it says that strong drink is a brawler, well, it's clarifying things, isn't it? Wine and stuff like that, it's showing the negative aspect of something. And it says both are generic words. They can and do designate the juice of the grape in every stage, in every state that it's you can find it. So you look at these. Which, by the way, if I'm not mistaken, somebody can correct me on this and look it up. But I think when they dip that sponge or whatever into that vinegar and put it up to Jesus, I think the word for vinegar is wine, is oinos. I think it is. I'll have to double check that. But it covers every range. Now, I want to leave the class with this at this point. I am, beyond a shadow of a doubt, convinced by study on this subject for years and years, not just me but others, that the Christian, maybe I ought to reword that, it is a sin to use alcoholic beverages that steals your ability to reason properly. We're told to bring every thought into the captivity of Christ. How do I do that if I'm ingesting something that's robbing me of that ability? Okay, I'll go you a step further. Some people say, well, I don't believe it's a sin, but I don't think a Christian should ever want to do that. I'll agree with that. We shouldn't even want to. We shouldn't want to say, well, you know, as long as I drink it in the privacy of my own home. You know, I'm just sitting out in the backyard on my patio, and I'm looking out at the scenery and watching the sunset, and I'm okay if I drink this or drink that or drink that. But you see, you had to get it from somewhere. And you're influenced. So I'll go that far. But I don't stop right there. I'll go a step farther than that. Why shouldn't a Christian ever be involved in the use of alcoholic beverages? Because you cannot become addicted to a product that you never taste. You cannot become addicted to cocaine if you never use it. You cannot become addicted to heroin if you never use it. You cannot become an alcoholic if you never use alcohol. Yes.
First step away is just wrong.
Okay, that's a good point. The first step away, or how about this, the first step towards sin. You know, it's one thing to say, well, I'm stepping away from God's word, but you know what, you're also stepping towards sin, aren't you? That's a good point. First step away becomes sin. And so it's a question of, I've always liked to use like this. Somebody says, well, what if I just drink like one glass of wine? I'm not drunk. I don't know if they still use this in law enforcement. They used to. Right here in Texas, they use the term one drink drunk. You know why they did that? Is because people would argue, well, I only had one and I don't get drunk at that point. You've already started taking your ability to reason and your capacity to make good choices away after that first drink. And I've heard people say, oh, no, that's not true. Well, if that's not true, then your second drink wouldn't do it either. And your third drink couldn't do it either because it's the same product. It's just a matter of degree, isn't it? How drunk are you? How drunk am I? Well, I only drank one. Well, then you're technically, as the law enforcement used to use the term, don't know if they do anymore, one drink drunk. You started that process. Any comments or thoughts?
So whenever Paul set up this, told about the qualification for an elder, he told them not to be much, have much wine.
Okay.
And then later on in the chapter, I'm in the book, he tells Timothy to drink wine for his stomach's sake.
Okay.
Well, he's saying for the elders not do what you just said, but he's saying, well, do the clean wine, I guess, for lack of a better term, to Timothy. Otherwise, there's a contradiction set up. If he's saying drink alcoholic wine for your stomach.
Yeah. Okay. And you know, again, they've said, okay, well, we found out that, you know, a glass of wine is good for the stomach, and maybe that's why Paul was doing that. But they've also shown that just plain grape juice is actually good for your stomach, too. So, again, there's another one when Paul told Timothy, drink a little wine for your stomach's sake. We don't know what that, you know, what he was actually instructing him to do there.
Well, what would the logic be behind him recommending to Timothy to take an alcoholic drink when he just told the elders to do it?
That's a good point. Why would you tell somebody to do it after you just said, "But you shouldn't be doing this"? So, yeah, I'm going to argue that again, there's a passage that you really can't say, well, I can concretely prove that Paul was telling Timothy to use an alcoholic beverage. Somebody else comes along and say, well, I can prove that they can't. Neither one of you under those circumstances, but if you bring in what Brother Jerry just pointed out, you might just get a little bit of education on it. You might understand what he was actually telling them. So that's a good point, Jerry. Excellent point. Anybody else? Am I going to actually give you a little bit of time back? Has that bell rung? I don't know. I have a hard time. You know, Mike wouldn't give any time back. I'm going to tell you right now, and you know that. So I may not give. No, I'm going to let you have some time back. Yes, no.
What was the title of that book? Was it Jeffcoat? Was his last name?
W.D. Jeffcoat. Yes. And I think the name of the book is The Christian and Social Drinking. I could kick myself for not bringing those two books. I could give you specifics.
We had neighbors we were trying to convert, and he was in the military. And he was trying to convert him, and he was talking to the deer that
Okay, that is an excellent point. You know, if your influence goes way beyond what you think it does, our time is up. I think Brother Velton's trying to tell me something, so we will stop it there. I appreciate your comments in class.